From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The cigarette industry is in trouble in America. Industry whistleblowers have stepped forward. Secret documents are no longer secret. The industry is facing lawsuits and the possibility of government regulation. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Kluger, author of a new history of the tobacco industry called Ashes to Ashes. Also, a new restored version of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, the 1964 film starring Catherine Deneuve, in which all the dialogue is sung. We'll talk with Michel Legrand, who composed the music for the film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. More flooding is expected in the Midwest. Thunderstorms over the weekend triggered the deluge. The Merrimack River in Missouri is expected to crest more than 12 feet above flood stage today. Several towns are threatened. 8 inches of rain in East St. Louis, Illinois, have forced officials to evacuate hundreds of homes there, and more are threatened. Authorities hope to use pumps to help drain portions of the city. At least 6 deaths in the Midwest are blamed on the bad weather. It's fire in the West. Thousands of acres are burning. Range fires in Arizona have charred more than 43,000 acres. Federal officials say 1,100 firefighters are on the front lines. They're hoping higher humidity and calm winds will help put out blazes in central, southern, and northern Arizona. Firefighters in Southern California hope improved weather conditions will help them as they battle flames in Ventura and San Diego counties. Searchers are still looking for former CIA Director William Colby. He's missing from his Southern Maryland home and feared drowned. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Divers and specially trained dogs are searching the waters and banks of the Wicomico River as the search goes into its third day. William Colby was reported missing by concerned neighbors on Sunday. His overturned canoe was found about a quarter of a mile from his home. According to Charles County Sheriff Fred Davis, the former CIA director had spoken with his wife by phone on Saturday, saying that he was tired but planned to go canoeing anyway. Investigators later found his radio and computer turned on and dishes set out for dinner. Sheriff Davis says the disappearance is being treated as an accident. There is no suspicion of suicide. William Colby served 30 years in the CIA and its predecessor, the OSS. He was director under Presidents Nixon and Ford. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
The Australian gunman accused of killing 35 people has been formally charged with murder. Authorities found the 35th body today while combing the rubble of an inn in Tasmania the gunman allegedly set on fire. Trent O'Keefe reports from Sydney.
Police believe the death toll has peaked at 35, 32 of whom were killed in a shooting rampage in the tourist town of Port Arthur, and 3 who died later while being held hostage at the farmhouse. The man accused of the murders has been remanded in custody for 3 weeks. 28-year-old Martin Bryant of Hobart refused to enter a plea to the first of what is expected to be 35 murder charges. The court was convened in a room at Hobart Hospital, where the accused is being held in protective custody while undergoing treatment for burns suffered in the blaze. After the hearing, police released details of an American who was among the 19 people injured in the mass shooting. He's Dennis Olson of Washington State. 4 of those killed are yet to be identified. For National Public Radio, this is Trent O'Keefe in Sydney.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down nearly 15 points at 5,558. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. China's rejected a Taiwanese request to open a dialogue, saying Taiwan has to stop asking for a seat at the United Nations. Chinese officials have also decided to be more firm in their efforts to reunify with Taiwan. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
In the days and weeks just after Taiwan's presidential elections last month, China's once vitriolic rhetoric calmed down so much that it seemed there might be an opening for the two sides to resume a cautious détente. Taiwan has repeatedly called for a resumption of talks. The Chinese government spokesman Shen Guofeng said today that Taiwan must first give up its bid for a UN seat and stop trying to develop its own relations with other countries. China sees Taiwan as a rebel province which deserves no international links nor recognition of its own. In the Chinese government's annual meeting on Taiwan, which ended yesterday in Beijing, senior officials called for a more aggressive approach to speed Taiwan's reunification with the mainland. They said this would include competing with Taiwan economically, diplomatically, and militarily. I'm Mary Kay Magstad reporting.
A private business research group says consumer confidence grew in April as consumers' worries about finding jobs dropped to a six-year low. The private conference board says its index jumped from 98.4 to 105.3. Analysts suggest the news indicates the Federal Reserve won't have to cut interest rates to stimulate the economy. The FBI has asked a Montana legislator and the state's assistant attorney general to talk with the anti-government group The Freeman. The FBI wants to talk about a plan letting the Freeman present their case at a forum in the Montana state capitol. Several Freeman are wanted on state and federal charges, including writing bad checks and threatening to kidnap and kill a federal judge. Members of the group have been barricaded at a Montana farm for more than a month. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The tobacco industry, after decades of brilliant advertising and public relations campaigns, is now under attack on several fronts. The industry is the subject of five federal grand jury investigations. It faces liability suits from the attorneys general of seven states, plus class actions and individual cases. And the FDA is trying to regulate cigarettes as nicotine delivery devices. My guest Richard Kluger has written a new history of the American tobacco industry called Ashes to Ashes. Kluger is also the author of Simple Justice, about the groundbreaking 1954 Supreme Court decision Brown v. Board of Education, which desegregated the schools. While Kluger was researching his tobacco book, several industry whistleblowers stepped forward, and secret industry documents were made public, leading many people to conclude that the tobacco industry manipulated nicotine levels to keep smokers addicted. I asked Kluger his reaction.
This is very old news. There's nothing in here. The fact is that all manufacturers control what's in their product. This industry controls not only the nicotine level, but the tar, the carbon monoxide, and all the other things that make it a very lethal product. It's been doing it all along. The tobacco comes out of the field and out of the curing warehouse being naturally addictive and lethal. The question isn't what they put in, but how much do they take out of this bad stuff? And the fact is, over the last 40 years, they have taken out a fair amount, a lot more from certain brands than from others. And I don't mean to suggest what's left on the market is safe, but the average cigarette today is about one-third as lethal in terms of being measured by nicotine and tar content as it was about 40 years ago. And there are many brands even less strong than that on the market. They're not safe, but they're less awful than they were.
But the charges now are that the tobacco industry knew that nicotine was addicting and tried to make sure that the levels were high enough to keep smokers addicted?
Well, there is no single level of addiction. These brands that are on the market have a tremendous range of nicotine and tar. A Marlboro or Camel, which are among the strongest, are about 15 times higher in nicotine than the low-end brands such as Now or Carlton or Merit Ultima. There is no one level. The smoker can choose if he wants to go to the trouble of finding one. Those that are lower. So that, I think it is a myth to say that they don't have to stay up nights trying to find a particular level that's going to addict the public. It's there. It's a matter of whether they take out more or less.
When did the medical profession first start to warn about the health hazards of smoking? How far back does that go?
In terms of what we would call modern science, we're really talking about the watershed year of 1950. Before then, smoking hadn't really been widespread enough and practiced strongly enough, or people didn't smoke all that much until about the 1920s. In terms of cigarettes, of course, we're talking about, and inhaling. It's the inhalation rather than smoking on a pipe or a cigar that does the damage. Smoking became more and more popular in this country after the First World War, and then during the Depression it reached the point by the middle of the century where almost half the adult population was smoking. That had given enough time for these slow-acting diseases, cancer and heart disease, chronic diseases, to incubate. These are slow-moving diseases, but they take about 8 to 12 years off the life of the average smoker. So it began to hit in the early 50s, and we started having population studies that were showing the exponentially higher death rates of smokers.
And the 1950s is also the period when the cigarette industry starts emphasizing filtered cigarettes. Is there a connection between the two?
Oh, sure. And this is a way of showing almost the perverse genius of the industry. Throughout, I found in the course of my book, the worse the medical news, the more money they made by being able to respond in ways that if it were some other kind of product, you'd say they're very clever. By putting on a filter, once the news started to come in about the danger, it said something bad is being taken out of the smoke, and therefore it encouraged smokers to continue. It allowed younger smokers to begin thinking perhaps there was less of a danger to them. In fact, the first 10 years, though, that filter didn't do very much. They used nicotine, tobacco that was heavier in nicotine, and for 10 years it was strictly a placebo. But starting in about the end of the 50s, they did start to improve by filters, by ventilation holes, by using different kind of tobacco, etc., to bring down those high toxic yields.
Yeah, just a statistic that you give in your book, Ashes to Ashes, that at the start of the 1950s, only one of 10 smokers used filters. By the close of the decade, more than 5 in 10 were smoking cigarettes with filters.
It was a major change.
So
also, it cost less to put out a cigarette with a filter than the tobacco, so they made more money on it.
Oh, really?
They had it going both ways.
And they had new brands to sell and new advertising campaigns to sell them.
Absolutely.
So more money, more money.
Absolutely.
One of the cigarettes, I think, that got started as a result of the filters was Kent. Didn't that get started in the 1950s?
Kent was essentially the first that made a serious effort to be an effective filter as opposed to just being a placebo. In fact, it succeeded so well that smokers couldn't get enough flavor out of the filter. And the company that did it, Lorillard, decided, well, we better loosen up the filter a bit so people can get the taste. And, of course, when they loosened it up, more of the bad stuff came through and defeated the whole point of the effort.
Now, you say that the Federal Trade Commission, by allowing companies to describe the filter tips and their benefits, validated the grand deception being foisted on the public. What do you mean?
Well, just by allowing the suggestion that a filter is a health benefit initially, it did, what I said earlier, it did allow smokers to feel, well, this is not so bad for us anymore. The FTC has gone up and down on this thing in many ways over the last 30 years. The whole government regulatory machinery has been very nervous about this product and unwilling to confront it. But initially, they did help and allow the industry to make it look as if this were really a health device that they were sticking on the cigarettes.
Richard Kluger is my guest, the author of a new history of the tobacco industry called Ashes to Ashes. One of the ways the cigarette industry came up with to make cigarettes seem like they weren't that dangerous was the low-tar cigarette. How did the low-tar cigarette start?
I think by the time the low-tar started to come in, the first one actually came right after the first Surgeon General's report, the landmark report of 1964. And that was, I think, genuinely an effort to put out a product that was measurably safer. You can't say it was safe, but just less less lethal. It was not very popular. Many smokers felt they couldn't. It was like just sucking in hot air, and it didn't work too well. But over the years, they figured out a way to make the low-tar cigarettes more flavorful. Beginning in the 70s, you got Vantage and Merit cigarettes, which are considerably less lower in tar and yet higher in flavor. That was a technological breakthrough that helped considerably.
Now, the impression I got from your book is that while lowering the tar levels, some of the brands kept up their nicotine levels. So, okay, you were getting less tar, but you were still getting plenty of the nicotine, ensuring that you'd keep craving cigarettes and also exposing yourself to the harms of nicotine.
Yes, they did work out. They felt because cancer was dreaded even more than heart attack as the principal health risk of smoking, they felt if they brought the tar down, that would be a way of being less of a cancer threat. But it is true they did try to disproportionately keep the nicotine a bit higher. Translation: they didn't take out as much of the nicotine as they might have. But there is no secret in this, in my view. The notion that this is something they did without our knowledge, the public's knowledge, certainly the public health community knew about the nicotine being in there. Smokers know that smoking is addictive, and the body of literature on the addictiveness of smoking goes back more than 100 years. So it's not as if they're doing something we all haven't known about.
But I think the tobacco industry denied the health hazards for so long, and they'd have, you know, professional PR people going around the country just trying to pretend like there was absolutely no health harm associated with smoking.
Well, there is no question. I'm not defending the industry. Their behavior has been unconscionable, but the locus of the bad behavior, I think, is not that they conspired to do things to the cigarette that we weren't aware of, but precisely in their denial of this massive evidence. Their own scientists produced nothing that exonerated the cigarette. Their own scientists, they would not commission to do the serious basic research into the causal relationship between smoking and disease. Nevertheless, without that, either of those happening, the industry for a generation has denied and distorted and belittled all this evidence against it, largely to reassure its customer base. And that is just unconscionable behavior.
How was it possible for the cigarette industry to come out with these low-tar and filtered cigarettes saying, hey, this is better, this is more healthy, without admitting that there was a health problem in the first place?
Well, they don't really admit. They're quite careful. And indeed, the new cigarettes that Reynolds is trying to bring out, the Eclipse, and they tried it with Premier a few years ago, they have to double talk. They're not prepared to say, because once they say that this cigarette is safer for you, is less dangerous, they would invite the FDA in the door and to regulate it as a drug or as a health product. They'll say things like it's a lighter cigarette. They used to say it's a milder cigarette. But they don't say it's less dangerous or it's safer. They do watch themselves, and their lawyers coach them endlessly on that kind of thing.
What did you find out about research into the health effects of cigarettes that was covered up by the industry?
I don't believe that they've covered up anything that the public health community itself didn't know either at the same time or even earlier. I'll give you one example. We've heard a lot about secret studies into a safer cigarette being done by Brandon Williamson lately and Philip Morris. In the 80s, Dr. Wygant has testified and spoken of that. Your National Cancer Institute, for a decade starting in the late 60s, invested $50 million on a safer cigarette project working closely with the tobacco industry. There was no secret that this was being done. Certain of the technological improvements I've mentioned were put in effect then, and we still have them. Liggett and Myers did it. They did produce a cleaner-burning cigarette, but they didn't bring it to the market, largely because their lawyers convinced the companies, and this is another sin, in my view, by the industry, that if you produce a safer cigarette, that means what you've got on the market is a less safe cigarette. Therefore, you're going to be sued, possibly out of business. And, of course, the logical extension of that is you'd never produce a cigarette that is less of a threat, less of a health menace to the public.
The safer cigarette that was suppressed, what was that designed to be?
The Liggett cigarette used various chemicals and additives to make it. It would be the equivalent of the cleaner-burning catalytic converter in a car to make the burn cleaner, so that it was designed to make the tobacco burn cleaner, and the oxygen level would be higher, and so you'd get less of the incompletely burned tar into your system. And that, of course, was less cancer-causing. And they had real tests that showed that it would be significantly less dangerous for you. And yet, they did not bring it to the market.
And they didn't bring it to market because their lawyers told them they could be sued.
That was what I found in my research. And they pretty much admitted that.
Richard Kluger is my guest, and he's just written a huge history of the tobacco industry called Ashes to Ashes. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Richard Kluger, and we're talking about his new History of the Tobacco Industry, which is called Ashes to Ashes. One of the recent revelations about the tobacco industry is that the industry put in flavorings, additives to the cigarettes, many of which had toxic effects. And this was considered quite a revelation. There were over 600 substances that were added. You don't think this is really very dramatic news?
No. It's simply more to what's in there already, which is terrible. These are, it's like putting a condiment on your very fat piece of corned beef or something that you're going to eat. The tar and nicotine and carbon monoxide content, the basic elements of disease formation in the cigarette, those are the dangers. Anything you add on top of that doesn't help. The fact is, almost anything that you burn and take into your body, inhaling it into your system, is going to be bad for you. It's going to be carcinogenic. These additives, though, are uncontrolled. And indeed, the whole product, cigarettes are uncontrolled. And that is really my gravest concern in terms of the public health reality of this product today.
Can you share with us a little bit about what you learned about the health effects of nicotine and tar?
Well, we have thousands of published reports dating back to the 50s and dozens of Surgeon General's reports dating back to the landmark report of 1964 that are just full of that information. The short of it is, one out of four smokers will eventually succumb to the smoking habit, and they will die on average 8 years before non-smokers, and about 400,000 or more, the numbers depend a little bit on how you calculate, die each year. If you multiply that out, that means Americans as a people lose about 4 million years of life each year to smoking, to one form or another of these diseases. Mostly of them, most of course, striking in the last years of their life, in loved ones' life. And they are perceived then as diseases of old age in a way and don't alarm us as much as, let us say, AIDS, striking people in their prime and therefore attracting much more attention than smoking deaths.
You end your book with some of your own proposals about regulating the cigarette industry. Give us what you think are your most important proposals.
I think if we're going to try to save smokers' lives, it's time to stop bashing these already discredited executives and stop suing suits that are not going to go anywhere in the law courts, but to really start to regulate this product, make it less lethal and less addicting and less seductive to our young people. We can do that, and we never have done anything like that. The principal way to do that, and we really have a proposal from the president on the table right now, and I think it may be implemented this summer, is to allow the FDA to exercise its jurisdiction over this product and say it is a drug, and well, there are a number of things we can do to make it less harmful. Starting with, in my view, bringing down the levels of tar, nicotine, and all these other things we're talking about over in a staged process. I wouldn't do it overnight. I would do it in 10 or even 15 years. Some product, by the way, some cigarettes already in that area are on the market today. This is not something that would be so low that no smoker could get any satisfaction out of it. And then the labels should be made larger. They should be made more honest. They should say it's addictive. The labels don't say that smoking is addictive. And they do not say what the dangerous ingredients are. This is unique. Every other product that we take into our body, food or drug, it tells you on the label how strong it is and what's in there. Cigarettes do not. They've been exempted. And I'm suggesting that the industry make a trade-off, that it come to the bargaining table, that it willingly accept, work out a deal with the FDA and Congressman Waxman and others in exchange for an immunity against it by these product liability suits, which are out there, which cost millions and even billions to the industry. And I think essentially the industry is going to win them all. But sooner or later, that will end, and it will help everybody if we could work out a deal in the next few years and save an awful lot of lives in the bargain.
How much of an influence has the tobacco industry had on Congress through funding candidates, through contributing to the campaigns of candidates?
I think that's where they're most successful in manipulating. It's not so much the nicotine, it's they manipulate the political process and do that very adroitly. It's not particularly subtle. It's money, and it's not so much the amount of money that they give to candidates across the political spectrum, but where they focus it. They have focused their efforts on the three key tobacco-growing states, whose legislators they have, whose power of those legislators, they have leveraged to get them to trade off their votes with, let us say, northern liberals or any other bloc, in order to keep federal regulators' hands off the tobacco industry. Let us say the North Carolina would be the leading delegation, Virginia and Kentucky are the other two states. These three states' congressional delegations have done all but fall on their swords to keep tobacco a privileged character. And the fact is, this product has escaped almost the entire web of consumer protection laws we have put in place in this country over the course of the 20th century, starting with the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906. Uniquely so. And what's dreadful about it is our most dangerous product.
Do you think that the tobacco industry will have an impact in the presidential election?
Well, they're certainly trying. It used to be that their support was bipartisan, of course, because the Democrats would control the Congress and Republicans for many years were in control of the White House. And, of course, no president before Clinton has taken any position against the tobacco industry. He is the first one to do that. And, of course, the industry is dead set against his reelection. Bob Dole has a long history of being friendly to the tobacco industry. He comes from an agricultural state. He had a natural affinity with the tobacco-growing states, has done much to help them, and has indicated he will continue to do that if he's elected.
Richard Kluger, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Richard Kluger's new history of the tobacco industry is called Ashes to Ashes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here is Ivy Anderson and the Duke Ellington Orchestra, recorded in 1936. The song is Love is Like a Cigarette.
Just like a cigarette, I never knew the thrill of life until I touched your lips. Then, just like a cigarette, love seemed to fade away and leave behind ashes of regret. Then with a flip of your fingertips, it was easy for you to forget. Oh, love is like a cigarette.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, composer Michel Legrand. We're listening to music he composed for the now classic 1964 film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Every bit of dialogue in the film is sung to Legrand's music. There's a new restoration of the film which is opening around the country.
Un peu en retard, le notaire n'en finissait pas, et je suis passé à la station. Maintenant tout est réglé.
Pauvre Élise, il ne restera rien d'elle.
Si si beaucoup de choses au contraire, tout ce que nous allons faire.
Tu es heureux,
très heureux, et c'est à toi que je le dois. Si Madeleine, tu le sais bien. Et toi, est-ce que tu es heureux?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, the 1964 French film, has been restored, and it's a revelation. Breathtaking isn't too strong a word for the use of color in this film, or for the music. All the dialogue in the film is sung to music composed by my guest, Michel Legrand, who also composed the music for Yentl, The Summer of 42, and The Thomas Crown Affair. The Umbrellas of Cherbourg was written and directed by the late Jacques Demy, and it made a star of the young actress Catherine Deneuve. Over the years, the film's colors had faded so badly you'd never know what the film really looked like. The restoration shows the original color and has a Dolby stereo soundtrack. The film tells the story of two young lovers who are broken apart when the young man, Guy, is drafted and sent to Algeria for 2 years. In this scene, the broken-hearted Genevieve, played by Deneuve, begs him not to leave her. He promises to love her for the rest of his life.
Mais je ne pourrai jamais vivre sans toi. Je ne pourrai pas, ne parle pas, j'en mourrai. Je te cacherai et je te garderai. Mais mon amour,
ce n'est pas possible.
Je ne te quitterai
mon amour,
pas.
Il faudra pourtant que je parte. Tu sauras que moi, je ne pense qu'à toi. Mais je sais que toi, tu m'attends. Pleure pas, je t'en supplie.
Michel Legrand, how did Jacques Demy first describe to you his idea of a movie in which all the dialogue would be sung?
You know, it went step by step, because Jacques came to me once with the, you know, because I've worked with him on two or three movies before. And we always spoke, him and I, about, you know, doing a musical or some musicals for the screen. And one day came to me with a script called The Infidelity of or The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And he wanted to shoot it in black and white, like a normal movie. So I read the script very carefully, 2, 3, 4 times. And then I came back to Jacques and I said, Jacques, I love it, but I think we should try to make a musical out of it. I said to him, you know, it would be very, very interesting to do it as a musical. Oh, Jacques said, hey, what a good idea. So we started to work. And first of all, we wanted to make it as a normal musical with spoken parts and singing parts. And we wrote a song here, we tried another song there, and it never worked really well, because we had a big problem between the passage, between what's spoken and what was sang. So I said, oh, you know, today it's impossible to really, then people that talk normally, and suddenly we hear the background, you know, the strings coming and say, oh, they're going to sing now. And all these kind of old-fashioned, you know, sounds, we said, no, that's not for us. So we abandoned the project. Said, no, I don't think it's a musical. And a few months later, Jacques said, you know, I have an idea, because we have a problem. gluing what's spoken, what's sung. Why don't we try to sing the entire movie? Like an opera from beginning to end. Hey, I said, geez, why not? So we started. And it took us a couple of months to really try to find which style, because I remember, you know, I was working by myself at home, and I started to write some, you know...
Actually, let me stop here, because I want to get to the part about the style in a moment.
Yeah.
But first I'd like to know your reaction when Jacques Demy said, well, let's do it like an opera where everything is sung. Did you think, hey, what a great idea, or did you think he was a little crazy?
No, because Jacques wasn't a crazy man. No, I said, you know, oh, I think it's a good idea, we should try. And then we tried, and I couldn't find, because, you know, when I started to work on it, it was very complicated, you know, classical, very modern classical music. And I said, and Jacques and I, we said to ourselves, you know, it should be, if we do something like that, it should be, music should be readable and understandable. The first time, Jacques said to me, it should be like a song, one song from beginning to end, like one aria, one thing, because he said people have to understand it the first time they hear it. You know, so I changed my mind, I changed my pencil, and I tried, and finally we came up with what, you know.
Yeah, and it's jazz and ballads.
Yeah, but mostly it's melodic, you know, from
very
beginning
melodic.
To
end. Yeah, well, right. Beautiful chords also.
Yeah, because, you know, they exist, so we have to use them.
What's that?
The chords, I mean, you know, we have to use the chords which are existing, so we use almost all of them.
Now, in a lot of ways, the Umbrellas of Cherbourg to me is like if you made An Ordinary Life into an MGM musical, and you took the sets of an MGM musical and combined that with the gas station on the corner, what would you get? Because it takes the scenes of Ordinary Life and kind of elevates it to the beauty of an MGM musical. Was that what you both had in mind?
No, we wanted to do a very ordinary story. You know, the ordinary triangle, because, you know, this beautiful young girl, she does not wait for her lover to come back, and she marries someone else. At the same time, we wanted to use very ordinary, everyday language, simple, very simple. So the music had to be very melodic, but exactly like one song from beginning to end, you know. And then the color will be very exaggerated. So it will be like it's a huge dream in a very ordinary life. This is what we wanted to, we tried to achieve. We never thought of American musical, nor MGM, nor anything. You know, just a French, typical French story in a provincial town with simple people, beautiful people, but simple.
Now, was the dialogue written first? Did Demy give you the dialogue and say, okay, now you can compose a score around it?
Yeah, because Jacques, you know, originally had written the dialogues on every scene. Since Demy wanted to shoot it as a normal movie, without music, without, you know, singing. And so we took scene by scene, and, you know, I come up with a tempo, with a melody, and then... We changed in every scene. We changed all the dialogue, because I said, Jacques, no, here I want da 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 da. So he adapted everything, and then he put one syllable under every note that I was proposing to him. So we worked almost, you know, we worked both together from beginning to end.
Now, I'm wondering if it was difficult for you to set the scenes that aren't the more romantic or disillusioned scenes, but just the more everyday scenes. Like, in the very beginning, there's a scene where Guy, you know, the romantic lead, is working at the gas station, and he's just fixed a customer's car.
Yeah.
And Guy says, finished, and the customer says, it rattles a bit when the motor's cold, but that's normal. That's not the typical stuff that people set to music.
No, absolutely not. No, this is why. And also, you know, when we decided to start, the film with jazz, with loud, you know, blurring jazz, you know, tune, to really shock the people for a few minutes and then come back to you know, a nicer, more romantic melody. We wanted to shock first to be able, because, you know, it was, we always, Jacques and I said that we know that our movie is not going to be commercial at all. We knew it. So we said we want to do the first of all exactly what we hope to do exactly, you know. He sees it. I was hearing it, and we said it's a pure, completely without any compromise, exactly what we want to do. And we, you know, we decided on the emotion, you know, in every page, in every line. And working, you know, it's beautiful to work together, because any idea I had for lyrics, any idea I had for music, we discussed it and we were together to decide to use it or not.
Why don't we hear the music from that opening scene in the gas station,
okay,
where Guy has just finished working on a car?
Yes, and you know what's funny, because the movie starts with "C'est terminé," it's finished. So we laughed, you know, Jacques and I said, because we start with "it's over."
Right. And he's saying it's finished to the customer whose car he just finished.
Yeah.
Okay, here it is.
C'est terminé. Oui. Le moteur cliquait encore un peu à froid, mais c'est normal. Merci. Merci. Faire une heure ce soir. Ce soir ça m'est difficile, mais je pense que Pierre est libre. Pierre, est-ce que tu peux rester ce soir?
Oui, tu vérifieras l'allumage de la Mercedes de monsieur.
This music from the opening scene of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which has just been re-released in a beautiful new print. My guest is the composer Michel Legrand. How else it was writing the score for this movie different from writing more conventional songs? Were you just writing a regular song?
No. It was very different, because first of all, you have to find the style, the overall style from beginning to end. So I used jazz, I used, you know, romantic things, I used, you know, many kind of ingredients, you know, in my cooking, to try to find the style. And it's sometimes pseudo classical, sometimes, but I think it's, everything is in one very serious and very rigorous style. As soon as you find it, then you have to find the melodies which goes very well with one before, you know, bringing the new one coming up. And so it's not a song work really. Because a song has, you know, a beginning and an end, and it ends, and there is never any end. So it's a very different work.
My guest is composer Michel Legrand. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michel Legrand. He composed the music for the 1964 film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The movie has been restored and is opening in cities around the country over the next couple of months. Even though you weren't setting out to write songs, there were a couple of songs from The Umbrellas of Cherbourg that became very famous on their own and had a life outside of the movie. And I'm thinking from the main theme, which is known, I think, to a lot of Americans as "I Will Wait for You," and "Watch What Happens."
Sure, but I mean, you know, we can all, anyone can always, you know, extract from a score, I mean, one melody and use it, you know, as a separate item.
Were you surprised that these became songs and became hits on their own?
Very much surprised, I'll tell you, because first of all, Jacques and I, we couldn't find any producer in Paris who would put one franc in an adventure like that. Nobody believed in it. We went, we auditioned, you know, to every possible producer in Paris, and nobody wanted to produce it because they said, no, you're a couple of young, you know, nice guys, but I don't believe that the audience will stay for 90 minutes, you know, in a dark theater while people on the, you know, on the screen are singing, you give me the sword, but then singing, say, no, it will never work. So hearing that for about a year, because, you know, we auditioned about for a complete year, Jacques and I, we knew that, you know, our movies, if by any miracle we could make it, would be a flop for sure.
And, of course, the movie was not a flop, and neither was the music.
Yes, it's very funny because, you know, at the opening night, you know, at the opening night, right away it was a success. So we were the first one amazed about it.
Now, I believe that none of the actors in Umbrellas of Cherbourg did their own singing. I believe each actor had a singer that dubbed for him or her. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Because Jacques wanted to have the exact, you know, actor or actress for each role, and I wanted to have the best singer, male or female, for each character. But it was easy, you know, because nobody is speaking one word in that movie, so we could choose any kind of singing voice, you know.
Now, when you were shooting the movie,
yeah,
and the actors had to lip sync to,
yeah,
the singers, was it hard for the,
no,
actors to get it just right and to,
no,
really be, because so many movies where, you know, where it's dubbed like that, it looks really phony.
I know. But I mean, you know, I was very, very careful with it, because when we recorded the singers, we asked the actors to be there at the recording studio. And we said to the actors, you have to say, bonjour, quelle heure est-il? How would you say that if you had to talk? So they said, bonjour, je vais bien. So we said to the singers, so you have to, you know, listen to the actor and try to sing in the speed that the actor would normally say it. So we worked very closely, you know, actors and singers together. All the actors were there when the singers were singing their parts in the studio with the orchestra. And after that, you know, we did some acetate discs, and we forced every actor and actress, you know, in the cast to work for a couple of months every day. And I was there with them almost every day to learn very well, you know, the music, the score. So when Jacques started shooting, they knew it very, very well. They rehearsed, and we rehearsed so many times that they knew it well. And my job during the shooting was behind the camera to look if every actor was in sync with their voices.
Now,
and they were beautifully. They knew it so well.
What did it sound like when the actors, in order to be convincing, were actually singing, even though you weren't recording their voices, because their voices were being dubbed? But they had to actually sing so that they'd look convincing. Did they sing well, or was it funny to listen to?
No, it was funny to listen to, because they don't sing well. But I said, you know, you have to sing. Don't just, you know, move your lips. Sing, scream, even if it's out of key, I don't care. But we must see, you know, you singing and acting. So they did it very well, very well.
I wish I could hear what that sounded like. I wish there was a recording
of
that.
No, I'm glad that you never heard it.
Instead, why don't we hear some more music from the original recording? This is one of the beautiful melodies from Umbrellas of Cherbourg that you composed. This is Americans will know it as Watch What Happens.
Mm-hmm.
This was so interesting to me because I knew the song first as Watch What Happens, which,
yeah,
you know, was a very kind of popular pop hit.
Mm-hmm.
It's such, the second time it's sung in the movie, it's a song of such longing and disillusionment and love. I mean, I'll just explain, there's a diamond merchant who's fallen in,
mm-hmm,
love with the leading lady, and he,
mm-hmm,
knows that she's in love with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But he knows that she was made for him. And he goes to her mother and says this: once I loved a woman, but she did not love me. Her name was Lola. Once disillusioned, I tried to forget. I left the country and went to the end of the world, but life was meaningless. Then by chance, I met you, and the moment I saw Genevieve, I knew she was made for me. And it's sung to this melody, a beautiful melody. Why don't we hear it, and then I'll talk to you about writing it.
Good.
Autrefois, j'ai aimé une femme. Elle ne m'aimait pas. On l'appelait Lola. Autrefois, déçu, j'ai voulu oublier. Alors j'ai quitté la France. Je suis allé au bout du monde. Mais la vie me paraissait sans attrait. Et puis le hasard m'a mis sur votre route. Dès que j'ai vu Geneviève, j'ai su que je l'attendais. Depuis cette rencontre, ma vie a pris un autre sens. À tout instant, c'est elle que je vois. Je ne vis que pour elle. Je ne pense plus qu'à elle. Chez vous. Parlez franchement, vous ne m'en voudrez pas. Il n'est bien sûr pas question d'influencer Geneviève. Geneviève Elie.
Michel Legrand, what did you think about when writing this lovely melody?
You know, I thought of this is what the film wanted at that moment. You know, it was not just one melody; it was part of the entire work. And when I found it, I said, I think it would be very beautiful there. So we tried, and it worked. That's very simple. I mean, it looks, you know, on surface very simple. It's not, but this is the best way that I would like to explain it.
You mean like the intervals are more surprising than you'd think?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, it's funny because the discourse seems very, very simple. And, you know, it's like three notes, but it's very complicated.
Tell me why it's complicated.
Because, you know, for me, the quality of a melody should, even if the melody is very complicated by itself, should sound to you like it existed for 1,000 years already. It should sound so natural. It should float naturally, like a bird singing his song. So I always try to, even if it's torn, you know, if it's complicated, sophisticated, it has to sound to you very natural. This is why I'm always looking when I write a melody, in any style, in any discipline. And this is what I tried on Cherbourg too.
Now, how did the song that we just heard, in which one of the characters sings about his lost love, how did that become Watch What Happens, the American pop hit?
Because, you know, when we finished the film, then I went to New York and I met a friend. I had a friend, his name is Don Costa. Don Costa was a very famous orchestrator in New York, beautiful, very good musician. And I said to the listener that saw it, I said, Michel, that's great. He said, why don't I publish it? And why don't, you know, we extract a couple, two or three tunes from that and try to make some songs out of it? I said, fine, go. So Don called Norman Gimbel, you know, the American lyricist. And Norman wrote I Will Wait For You, and he wrote Watch What Happens. So we were very happy with it, and this is how it became, you know, songs.
My guest is Michel Legrand, and he composed all the music for The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, the 1964 film. There's a new print of it, beautiful restored print that's already opened in New York, and will be opening around the nation in the weeks to come. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
back with composer Michel Legrand, and he composed the music for the 1964 film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Earlier when you were talking about how you and the director Jacques Demy were first conceiving of Umbrellas of Cherbourg, you said that one of the difficult things when you were thinking it would be a conventional musical was how do you get from the speaking parts to the singing parts? That transition on film always looks awkward. People always have a hard time with that. Have you, what has it been like for you to do musicals where you do have to make that transition from speaking to singing, where it's not sung all the way through?
We did, because right after Cherbourg, I mean, the success of Cherbourg, every producer who refused to produce Cherbourg came to us and said, oh, great, you guys, make us another Umbrellas of Cherbourg. So we said, no, thank you. We've done it once. It's over. Now we'll do something else. And then we did a conventional, or so-called conventional musical called The Young Girls of Rochefort, with spoken parts and singing parts. And then I think we achieved pretty well, you know, the transition between what's said and what's sung.
And was it hard to make that transition between what's said and what's sung?
Hard, yes. Everything is hard. But it, you know, you have to be extremely keen and extremely, you know, subtle to bring the music when, you know, and suddenly, naturally, someone starts to sing. Not easy.
Michel Legrand, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, Théo, it's a pleasure.
Michel Legrand composed the music for the 1964 film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The movie has been restored and is opening in cities around the country over the next couple of months. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Roberta Chirac directs the show. I'm Tariq Gross.
Geneviève, ma petite Geneviève,
Guy, je t'aime. Tu sens l'essence.
C'est un parfum comme un autre.
Guy, je t'aime, oh Guy, je t'aime. Un client, je me sauve à 8 heures devant le théâtre. J'ai pensé à toi toute la journée. Si tu veux mon amour, après nous irons danser.
Si tu veux.
Si tu veux. Vous désirez
un parapluie.
Un parapluie. Où étais-tu? Là, en face. Êtes-vous fixé sur le genre d'article qui vous intéresse?
Un parapluie noir.
Geneviève, montre les parapluies à monsieur.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.